Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and we've got a jam-packed show for you as we are going to be talking about all that's going on in the world of college fall ball. I am joined by Matt Kinnear, Kevin Brown, and Christian Sweezy, and we are going to start with the most recent and work our way back. I think that depending on time zones, this is actually the second most recent, but we're going to give it a little bit of leeway. The Bob Kemp Lacrosse Classic, an annual event held at Georgetown Prep in North Bethesda, Maryland. Very important distinction, that North Bethesda, Maryland. This year featuring Georgetown versus Virginia. And Kinnear and Sweezy, you guys were on site. So we are going to hear from you from there. We will talk about Notre Dame versus Harvard in Chicago. We will go back to Saturday and talk about Maryland, Penn State, Lehigh, and St. Joe's. We're going to ratchet back a week and talk about North Carolina versus Yale, where Kevin Brown was in attendance. And then we're going to hear from Matt's visit to Towson practice and mine from Johns Hopkins practice last week. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And Christian, we'll start with you. This was most notably a defensive affair, not necessarily a hallmark of the Bob Kemp Classic. I remember watching, I believe it was Harvard, Carolina play an 18-15 type game a couple years ago. But no, it was the Ty Banks show for the Hoyas as they emerged one goal, quote-unquote, victors. What did you see out of both teams at Georgetown Prep?
If we were to do the hockey sort of three-star thing, and I'm still confused on who gets the third star and who gets the first star, but the three stars to me were defenseman Ty Banks, long stick Mitty Ben Ware, and goalie Anderson Moore. So I think that really typifies the sort of day it was. The defenses were a lot of fun to watch. And as you know, Terry, at the end of three quarters, which is basically the starters versus starters part of the scrimmage, it was 7-6, 13 goals in three quarters. So that was a little bit of a surprise. And as someone who likes defense, I actually rather enjoyed it. But yes, both defenses were extremely strong. And Virginia, I think, we'll probably get into this more in a bit, but if I were Georgetown and I was playing Virginia without their two starting short 60 middies and without two starters on close defense and scored seven goals in three quarters, I might be concerned. So I think that Virginia will have a lot to feel good about despite the air quote loss in the scrimmage.
Matt, what'd you think?
Yeah, Christian, I think the theme that we're going to hear, on the last podcast we've done and on every podcast going forward is just more question marks than ever this year. When you compare it to the last, four seasons with, all the extra COVID guys and, seemingly this class of people who dominated college lacrosse, dominated the headlines over the past few years coming back. So both of these teams, it felt like there were a lot of question marks going into this fall. And I don't necessarily think you answered them. One of the points that I think was most important, when you try to look, maybe not with just personnel and the names of who's playing, but just the overall physicality and the like, Georgetown really hung with Virginia in terms of like the athleticism, the physical play. I don't know the last time you would have been able to say that, right? Seeing Georgetown guys outrun Virginia guys. And I don't think it's certainly a thing of saying that, Virginia didn't give the effort or anything like that. It just goes to show kind of, some of the things that are switching in and out of both of these programs. And I think it is worth noting, who was there and who wasn't there, especially in these fall ball scrimmages. Virginia, as you mentioned, Christian, lots of guys out. Kyle Colsey, who, is going to be out for the year. He's one of the top freshmen in the country on that number one recruiting class. Ryan Dunkel hasn't played yet in the fall. He wasn't there. Who else, Christian, for Gobriel wasn't there. There was a lot of guys who weren't playing for the Cavaliers.
For UVA, it was both short stick D middies, Terenzi and Chismar, and also Schroeder and Kaloji on the close defense.
Yeah, and then for Georgetown, Jack Schubert, who's injured, he wasn't there as well. Take all these things with a grain of salt. When you look at the final score, don't just take it by that. But I was really impressed with the physicality and athleticism of Georgetown. And the face-offs were something that maybe in the moment didn't quite realize how much it turned the tide on this thing. But, Georgetown really had the edge on the faceoffs there earlier with James Ball. I think he probably won 75% of the first 10 draws or so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and it started to even up as the game went on. But you have to be really excited about that if you're the Hoyas. You mentioned Anderson Moore. But another guy that I wanted to talk about is Will Tominovich, because he was someone who, you know, I had an opposing coach texting me, like, how's he look coming back from injury? And he looked like he was a number one defender. You know what I mean? There was times when Banks typically was on Millen, but certainly there was a liberal switching off and doing everything they could. And, he was playing like a number one defender. He didn't look like he lost a step. I know there was question last year of whether he was going to come back at some point during the spring. But he looks fully, you know, like a fully realized, ready-to-go lacrosse player. So you have to be super excited about Georgetown's defense. And Virginia, I think they were a little vanilla on what they were trying to do on offense. I think they were just kind of getting the ball out there and playing. I feel like Georgetown was maybe a little bit more scout-centric, a little bit more buttoned up in that regard. But I think you are seeing that, like, you know, Virginia has some question marks that they're going to have to answer on this offense. Don't take away any credit from Georgetown's defense, but, you know, just a few question marks they got to iron out there.
The other thing I want to hear from both of you guys, too, is the big storyline to really end the season for Virginia was in between the pipes. You mentioned Anderson Moore being having a great day, making that leap from his freshman year to sophomore year. Sweezy, you're right up. You mentioned, Coach Lars Tiffany mentioned that Matt Nunes is not in a slump anymore, but Kyle Morris is just giving everything he has to this goalie competition. What did you see from both those guys, and how did it all play out?
It was so interesting because Nunes, interesting to me, Nunes started, played the first quarter, Morris played the second quarter, Morris played the third quarter, and Capstar, the freshman, played the fourth quarter. And so I don't think I've ever seen, in all my years of doing fall ball, I don't think I've ever seen a starting goalie play only one quarter. And my guess, it looked to me as if Nunes will play the first quarter, Morris will play the second quarter, whoever's playing better will get the third quarter, and then the freshman gets the fourth and fifth. And Morris did play better. My numbers, I think I had Nunes for four saves, three goals against, and Morris was more like nine saves and four goals against. And Morris took up a lot of the cage. I think clearing, they were both about even. Nunes is certainly better outside the cage on other things. But yeah, if you're asking me who looked better, I thought Morris looked better.
It's interesting to me that I'm not discrediting or disagreeing with the amount of focus played on the goalie battle, because certainly that was a huge storyline for Virginia at the end of last season. But at the same time, a team that loses Connor Schellenberger and Peyton Cormier, I think that the rightful focus would be, how is this team going to score goals? And you've already addressed that there were guys out and that there were some injuries. And certainly with McCabe Millen, there is a very clear path toward having a star-led offense. But what can you say that would potentially allay concerns or give hope to Virginia fans who want to see their team score 15 goals a game?
Not much. I didn't see an offense that was going to do that. I saw a team that had very good defense. It was probably going to win faceoffs and Gobriella's back. And honestly, if I see them, you know, I could see their midfield scoring coming from Ben Ware in transition. I could see their midfield scoring coming from Terenzi in transition, or if, you know, Hausman, I know Kinnear, he caught your eye, the freshman who was playing more defense on Sunday. I think going forward, he would be more of a two-way, or perhaps even playing offense. You know, Hackett, the transfer from Bryant, looked really quick. Shuts, you know, a couple shots at the pipe. I don't think he scored. You know, Lars is completely wants his attack to be Millen, Truett Sunderland, and a lefty. And they started with Colsey as the lefty, and then they went with Menke as a lefty. I think there's, you know, Balsamo might get a look there, according to Lars. And I think they're still trying to figure out that third part. And, you know, the attack to me looks a little small physically. You know, I don't think Millen is small necessarily, but he's going to have to get ready to be guarded by the number one. And I thought Ty Banks won that matchup on Sunday. Sunderland is skinny. You know, Millen's a little bit skinny. Menke's a little skinny. Colsey's physical, but I don't, you know, I just love him as a midfielder. He's such a good dodger. And I just don't know where you're going to get that size. You know, Cormier was such a big presence inside. I'll never forget that St. Joe's first round game where I think he had more shots at one point in the third quarter than the entire St. Joe's. I think he'd taken 17 and St. Joe's had taken 16. And he was just so big, and it was so easy to throw him the ball, and he could put his shots on cage. I don't know that Virginia really has that. And I think they're still trying to figure it out. And I think the fall, you know, Colsey played the first quarter, as lefty attack. Menke played the second quarter lefty attack. I don't think Virginia knows these answers either. I do think that they will get a lot of goals from Ware. I think they will get a lot of goals from Terenzi, or at least a lot of goals, assists. You know, they'll be involved. And 6-on-6, I don't know that this is going to be your typical Virginia team.
Christian, when we were watching this game, you know, we were, I think, surprised that it was so close while we were watching it, that Virginia was always within striking distance, despite kind of some, it felt like possession, just Georgetown had the ball forever, and it felt like they were up by 4 or 5 goals when they were only up by 1 or 2 in those moments. But also, like, I do feel like, on the other hand, and this is kind of contradicting what I just said, that Virginia didn't feel that far away in terms of its transition. You know, there were
no agreed
opportunities where, you know, they just felt a little off, you know, like a pass a few inches the other way, a bounce goes a different way. They could have gotten, you know, 4 transition goals and really kind of allayed any of these concerns pretty quickly. But to answer your question of, like, Terry, your initial question about, you know, the concerns of the offense, I do think you have to say that the depth is there. You know, when you got into the fourth quarter, when you got into later in the game, you know, guys like Mikey Harmeyer, you know, he had a number of goals. Tucker Mullen had a really nice diving score. You know, you were talking about Ryan Colsey. You know, he's another guy who kind of stepped up. So I do think that they have a lot of guys there. And Balsamo was someone who, you know, he certainly had the ball on his stick a lot. I don't know if he produced a ton of points, but, you know, he was certainly getting his chances. He was getting underneath. You know, had some nice shots at the goal and such there. You know, Hackett was another guy that, again, I don't necessarily think he was very productive, but he had his shots. He has his quickness, and he, you know, he got loose for a few of them. I definitely think the depth is there. They certainly need to figure out kind of, you know, who's your go-to guys, who's your starters, and tighten things up a little bit. But, I mean, to your point about Ware, does that guy ever stop? He took... You know, this is fall ball, and I mean, gosh, when did he first come off the field? I don't even know, Christian. I mean, it was like he was on every wing. He was playing defense. He was involved in probably the first 3 or so, like, Virginia offensive rushes in a very significant way, and stayed out there on offense. He's a guy that just he's not going to stop.
He the first shot of the scrimmage was from Ben Ware off a faceoff, and it was saved, actually, by Anderson Moore. He took a second shot later. Remember, Kinnear, you and I said he had come down on a break, and he passed, and the kid he was passing to on the left, it must have been Colsey, thought the shot was coming. And so the ball was ticked off the stick, went out of bounds, and to your point about how many chances they could have had but didn't quite finish. And then Ware did score on this beautiful kind of spinning shot that he put past Anderson Moore. And again, you're talking about through 3 quarters, starters versus starters. Virginia scored 6 goals, and he had 1. So if he's going to... You know, I don't know if he's going to factor into 1/6 of the goals for the whole year, but he is a major presence on their offense, and I think they're very comfortable with that. Almost like a Loyola of 2012 with Ratliff and Hawkins, you know, and Laconi to a certain extent. But, you know, Loyola was completely comfortable having that be a complete staple of their offense, and I think Ware is going to be a major part of this Virginia offense, scoring and assisting.
That's a really interesting comparison because – the transition offense to me was always complementary. The core, the fundamental of their offense was Davis Butts dodging from up top, Justin Ward dodging from behind, and then spraying the ball all around to Eric Lusby on the left wing, Mike Sawyer on the right wing, and Sean O'Sullivan up top for those step downs. The reason I find it an interesting comparison is because what I feel like was the reason that was one of the best teams of the last 15 years for Loyola is because their offense was so sustainable and repeatable when it needed to be. And that's why I think the transition is complementary. What's interesting listening to this conversation is I'm not disputing that Virginia can find a lot of offense in transition. I wonder whether or not that's going to be sustainable and repeatable enough for them to be competitive at the very highest level. And so, you know, a month ago, we recorded a video previewing the 25 season, and one of the things that we really spent a lot of time talking about was just how unnatural it felt that Virginia and Duke probably do justifiably belong in that preseason 6, 7, 8 range, and everything about this conversation is reaffirming that for me. And it's an interesting contrast to my impressions coming away from watching Penn State and Maryland take on Lehigh Joe Santoliquido watched them take on St. Joe's. And it's not to say that there isn't a not insignificant gap between Lehigh and St. Joe's versus Georgetown, but we're talking about, you know, NCAA first-round teams versus a quarterfinalist. It's not the biggest distinction. And ultimately, when it came down to it, you know, Penn State and Maryland took care of business against the two non-ACC Big Ten teams. And so, yeah, I think that it's – I asked you if there was anything that could give hope to or allay concern from UVA fans, and you said not really. And 10 minutes in, I think that that's the right answer.
The one thing I would say to Kinnear's point about the depth is that on Sunday, Charles Bosama was on the second midfield line to start. Again, he played attack. He moved around a little bit. But that's a, if he's your second midfielder, you actually have some options, and without Ryan Dunkel even having played yet. So I think that there are options. But, yeah, I really see this as a team that's going to, you know, maybe they're going to win games 12-9 instead of 15-13.
I do think one thing we haven't I don't want to shortchange the guys on Georgetown's offense. You know, because again, with Schubert out, and you know, I definitely think, and all the guys that they've graduated, you know, I certainly think that there's a little bit of like, all right, well, who's scoring for them? Cade Caggiano was a guy who had a really good day. I believe he's from North Carolina, Caggiano, and then freshman Kevin Miller was another guy who I would say is a standout. Aiden Carroll, you know, my read on it was he started at attack and maybe has played a good amount of attack for them this offseason, but he seemed to pretty quickly shift back to kind of that first midfield role. So, you know, they're certainly like they're shuffling. There's things that they're figuring out. This is what fall ball's for. But certainly some guys who maybe are not household names will be contributing a lot of points this spring.
And I thought Georgetown, you know, to me, Georgetown looks like one of those teams where you say the first one to 10 goals wins. You know, I could see Georgetown being in so many 11-8, 10-9, 10-8 type games. Their defense is so good. They're winning faceoffs. They have a very good faceoff coach in Ted Moon. They've obviously devoted some resources to that position, which they should have. Probably the best goalie in the country, Anderson Moore. I'm not immediately coming up with anyone who is consistently better. And I think that'll be part of it. And, you know, I think they have a formula. Losing Schubert, who's out for the year, to my understanding, he's this attackman from Lake Braddock in Northern Virginia who really played well toward the end of last year. And even on the club level, I was told, you know, he was on the star set of club team, and that toward the end of his high school career, when they were in crunch time, he was the one who would get the ball. He's tall, he's rangy, good athlete. And again, a little bit Virginia being small stature size on attack, you know, without Schubert, I think Georgetown's a little bit small there too, which is why another player from North Carolina, Ransom, the freshman, was on attack. He's a bit of a broader body, good outside shooter, good inside finisher. So Georgetown strikes me as one of those teams. They're not going to have a 35 goal scorer. They're not going to have a 30 goal scorer the way they have with Bundy and Verdaro in years past. But they will have a lot of guys in that 15 to 20 range and just a lot of kind of who gets a hot hand. You know, I liked Owen Horning, a freshman from Georgetown Prep, actually. So, you know, very good off ball, very good shooter, different release points on his shot. You know, on one of his only goal, he had one goal and one assist. His only goal was on a rebound and kind of a garbage goal, and he just, you know, grabbed it, put it into the cage. But he can do some things for them. And I'm curious to see how Furley looks, a freshman from McDonough. He did not play Sunday. He was coming off an injury and had just returned, and they held him out. I think if it had been a regular season game, he probably would have played. Same with Terenzi at Virginia. But I'm curious to see what Furley can do, because by all accounts, he's excellent.
The one name I do want to add, and I know we have a lot to get to, is Fulton Bayman, the transfer from Notre Dame. You had in your report, he had a couple goals. Coming from TJ Haley, the pass-first quarterback, to a guy who can actually put the ball in the back of the net a little bit more, that might be an exciting development too for Hoya fans offensively if he can kind of take that quarterback role.
And one of the things thank you, Kevin, for mentioning that, because one of the things that I think is rather ominous for the lacrosse world is that Bayman is the guy who didn't really play much at Notre Dame, and all of a sudden he's at Georgetown, and he scored the first two goals of their first scrimmage and clearly had the ball a lot. And what does that tell you about where Notre Dame is right now? Because, you know, that's the guy who played barely at all last year, and all of a sudden
deluded, he's a two-time champs.
Right, exactly. I think that's so there are two ways of looking at that. One is heartening to Georgetown fans, and one is not to people who are hoping Notre Dame doesn't three-peat.
Well, and I think that's kind of that's a good place to go next. Is, you know, Notre Dame was scrimmaging against Harvard. It was Jerry Byrne playing you know, against Kevin Corrigan in an event benefiting Owls, the Playing for Peace event that was held in Chicago. And like you said, is everyone, you know, Coach John Tillman at the end of last year said, you know, I think we were all playing for second place, something to that regard. Does it feel like we're just kind of speculating who's going to be the national runner-up in all this stuff? Is Notre Dame set for back-to-back-to-back? Obviously, that's a bold statement, and it's way too early to make that prediction. But the beginnings of that is, you know, what you see in fall. And, you know, I'll contrast it with, you know, Notre Dame last year was in the Bob Kemp Lacrosse Classic. You know, they got crushed by Princeton. You know, there was no way about it. You know, they had something crazy amount of guys who were injured. You know, the Cavanaughs weren't there. You know, it was something like 20 guys who were not playing. So take it with a grain of salt, as you do with everything. But they wanted to win the national championship. This year, they scrimmaged against Harvard. We had Drew Brennan there at the game. Terry, you've kind of been in contact with him and been able to kind of get a feel for what happened in that game. What can you tell us from Notre Dame versus Harvard?
Yeah, so I think that obviously if you were coming at it from a Notre Dame perspective, the two things you'd be most interested in are the goalie battle, who's going to replace Liam Entenmann, and the offense without Pat Cavanaugh, and probably more specifically, what does it mean for Chris Cavanaugh? So with respect to the goalie battle, it was Alex Zepf who got the start, and then Richard Daly came in relief, and Will Omek played the fourth quarter. So kind of seems like Zepf is going to carry a little bit of a lead into the spring, and that makes a little bit of sense from a seniority standpoint. We'll see whether Richard Ellie can put together a kind of late fall and early spring that supersedes that and kind of overtakes that area of the field. And then I don't know that the scrimmage gave the best look at what Notre Dame is going to look like offensively because there were so many absences. You know, they've got three guys in Jordan Faison, Matt Jeffrey, and Tyler Buckner who are out due to football. And they also, you know, had a player who was in Jake Taylor who was gone because he was playing sixes with Team USA. So I think that to that end, I'll put it this way. Brady Picorni, a freshman, scored 5 goals. What is Brady Picorni's role if Jake Taylor is on the field, right? So I think that from that standpoint, probably valuable to, again, take a little bit of a grain of salt in terms of like the composition and how everything fits together. But at the same time, if you put in a performance like that, it becomes very difficult for your coaching staff to look the other way. And so I think that, you know, as a baseline, the notion that I would take away is somebody's going to have to beat out Brady Picorni for one of those spots. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not anybody's able to do it, and if so, who it is.
One of the things, too, I was thinking about with Jeff, the names you mentioned, especially Jeffrey and Faison, is, you know, historically, you look at Navy, Bilderback, you know, all the 8 national titles in the 60s, and he had football guys. 98% of the football guys that Bilderback had at Navy playing lacrosse were playing defense. And he said, I don't think, you know, we can teach you lacrosse, we can teach you footwork. I don't think we can teach you enough to make you a good shooter or a good dodger or a good passer. And I'm so impressed that Notre Dame is able to have Jeffrey and Faison, who play offense, and Faison plays it rather well. And I would expect Jeffrey would too. I think that's a little bit different from what historically the sport has seen from the two sport football lacrosse crossovers.
No question. And I think that it speaks to a handful of factors, A being the desirability of playing lacrosse. And obviously Buckner, you know, is an example for that. I mean, he's a player who left Notre Dame to go to Alabama for a multi-million dollar NIL deal. And then when it came to his desire to come back to Notre Dame, it started from the lacrosse standpoint. And, you know, that dynamic is not something that has been prevalent. And you watch NFL on Sundays, and I would say more games than not, there's a former high school lacrosse player on the field. And I remember when Jonathan Myers was on the cover of Inside Lacrosse recruiting issue because he chose to play lacrosse at Princeton when he had the opportunity to play football at Florida, and how big of a deal that was at the time. And I think that combined with, and this is an interesting conversation for you, Christian, because let's call him mid-2000s to Wharton winner, was at a lacrosse college lacrosse event within the last couple weeks, and he texted me after being there and said, has the sport gotten less athletic? And so I think it's important to be mindful of the fact that the person asking me is one of the best athletes that's played the game in a very long time. But my notion was, if it has, it's because it's actually gotten more skilled. So effectively, how hard it is to catch up skill-wise simply because of how athletic you are has gotten wider. And so my assumption is that if the sport in aggregate or who's being put onto the field on game days seems less athletic than 20 years ago, it's not because those athletes aren't playing. It's because they're at the end of the bench and they can't get on the field because the skill floor is too high, whereas that athlete would have been able to get onto the field 10 or 15 years ago. What do you think of that notion? And certainly when it comes to Faison, and obviously we haven't seen Jeffrey compete at this level yet, but you know, to your point, let's assume that he can. It's incredible what it says about basically how long these guys have been playing, how dedicated they've been to their craft, and how skilled they're able to be when you combine that with the natural athleticism that allows them to do what they're able to do on the football field.
It's amazing. I mean, I still remember Doug Shanahan, who I think won the first to Wharton at Hofstra.
It was not Doug Shanahan, for clarity, that reached out to me with that point.
You're so funny. But Shanahan, I think, later had to try it with the Jets. And, you know, McEnany had had the late Eamon McEnany had try it with the Jets. But Shanahan was the guy who wasn't super skilled. I don't think he would mind my saying that. But he was rugged. He could face off. He could get ground balls. You know, he could shoot well enough. He was almost like Courier at Princeton with the football element added to him. I think Courier was more hockey. But that was who he reminded me of. He could just do a little bit of everything, but it wasn't like a super duper skill set. And he was more kind of hard nosed and blue collar, and it fit Hofstra perfectly, those teams. And he was really good. They beat Virginia one year, thanks to Doug Shanahan. So he was certainly skilled. I was struck, and I talked to a couple of people, you know, this Georgetown team reminds me of those 04, 05, 06 teams that really relied on a Brant Gresham and, you know, Pat Cook and just a solid, rugged, hard-nosed team. And even Virginia, when I looked at it, I said, oh, wow, two of their three starting attackmen are from the NIAA. It's 1985 again. You know, sort of teasing people. Like, we're so used to North Carolina and Florida and the West Coast, like Tyler Buchner. And yet here, you know, you're still getting these wonderful players from Baltimore who are rather good. And so I think that the sport is in kind of an interesting place. I can't quite read it yet. As much as I love, you know, when Maryland made the title game, I think against Loyola in 2012, and their midfielders were from North Carolina, Florida, and Seattle. I was like, wow, that's not the way Maryland normally does it. And I don't think Buddy Beardmore could have pictured that in the 1977 title game or 76 title game. So but I think it's an interesting point and certainly something to keep an eye on.
Well, especially I'll just bring up the first line midfield that Notre Dame rolled out there on this weekend that Drew Brennan noted. Fisher Finley, who is on the infamous third line midfield in that national championship run last spring, he was joined by Will Angrick and Max Busenkel, and all three of those guys, I'd wager, are like, put them on another program who doesn't have as much depth, and they're surefire All-American candidates. So the skill plus the skill from a guy from Busenkel, and like the athleticism from Fisher Finley, and I think Will Angrick's like the kind of perfect mold of combining the two. Just they are rich in that midfield position. So excited to see the football guys join them in the spring for sure.
And one of the things that Drew noted that was kind of interesting was that Ben Ramsey was playing offense, and coming off of that incredible breakthrough season in 2023, he was kind of my pick to potentially fill into the Brian Tevlin, Quinn McCann role. And we didn't see that last year, but certainly a factor was how rich they were in terms of offensive talent. Now that even though they still have a ton of depth, there might be a little bit more opportunity. You know, maybe Ramsey's offensive skill can come to fruition. But with all that being said, we shouldn't give too short a shrift to Harvard. And I should have, I mean, I actually feel good that I don't think we've mentioned the again, quote unquote, final score. I believe it was 19-7, but if it wasn't, then that reinforces the point, which is that final scores don't matter in the fall. But, you know, what does is performances. And again, similar to Notre Dame, there were some kind of compelling storylines for the Crimson as well. Starting with goal, Christian Barnard graduated after being the starter last year. And, you know, certainly the dynamics of that were going to be compelling, given that Graham Stevens comes in as the number 15th ranked recruit in the class. And he got the start, and Teddy Kim played the second half for the Crimson. So that was one thing to be mindful of. And then some of the depth that they showed offensively. Graham Blake has gone to Duke as a grad student. Sam King didn't play against Notre Dame, so a lot of the burden fell to Teddy Malone as the lone returning starter that was playing offense. Andrew Perry, who missed last season due to injury, was back and playing midfield. And beyond that, I believe he was the only multi-goal scorer. They got those contributions kind of all up and down the roster that I think was the hallmark of when Harvard was playing really well each of the last three seasons. It was that distribution of scoring, whether they were putting up big goal totals like they did against Yale, or, you know, winning some of the closer games, some of the lower scoring games that they were engaged in as well. You know, this is another group that, while King is going to threaten to be an 80, maybe 90 point scorer, beyond him, it certainly projects that they've got, you know, 7-8 guys that can crack the 20 point barrier. And that versatility and variety both gives you injury insurance and also gives you matchup flexibility on a game to game basis.
Terry, let's move on to where you were at Saturday. You were up in Philadelphia area at Springfield Delco High School. A scrimmage that I attended, this, you know, set of scrimmages last year. This year it's Penn State, Lehigh, Maryland, and St. Joseph's. A Philly flavor, you know, obviously Penn State, Lehigh, and St. Joe's, but Maryland always seems to have a contingent of Maryland guys on the roster, and a lot of history with some of their greatest players of all time being from the Philadelphia area. Maryland is a team that I'd argue might be one of the most interesting teams in the country this year. Got to the national championship game last year with a team that nobody really thought should be there. Have a significant amount of losses. You know, a lot of shakeups. Obviously, a guy who was a Tuorton-esque player on defense in Ajax Apatella. Brought in what we call the number one transfer class in the country. And also graduated a faceoff guy who felt like was playing faceoffs, who was taking faceoffs for what seemed like 7 years. So, like, that's kind of the place where I think is best to start. It's face-offs and transfers. You know, the transfers, I think, gives them a new look, like, at least on first glance, of like, oh my gosh, there's a lot of guys who are over 6'4". And the face-offs, obviously, it's probably a little bit alarming not to see, you know, such a great specialist be there at the X for Maryland.
Yeah, so, as you mentioned, four teams, two fields. Joe Sanliquido handled the front field, which St. Joe's played on both games. I can talk a little bit about his observations, both by virtue of, you know, talking to him. I was able to kind of glance over at certain moments and see for myself, and then also from having edited that post. And then on the backfield was Lehigh versus Maryland, and then Lehigh versus Penn State. So I stuck with the backfield, and I also, as you mentioned, walked up right as the game started, and my first impression was, wow, Maryland looks bigger. And Maryland does what they always do, which is swap their jersey numbers. And fortunately, by virtue of being at field level, hearing the guys talk to each other and some other you know, helpful third parties, was able to glean most of whom was whom. But there were a couple of guys that you couldn't just not realize who they were. And it started with Noah Armitage, the Canadian grad transfer from Stony Brook, who just, you know, there's a lot of confirmation bias here, so I wouldn't take this comparison too much as gospel, but he really did remind me of Brian Cole in terms of two things. The first was how much he roamed the interior of the Lehigh defense, and then secondly, how vertical his stick is in terms of how he protects his stick and how he basically likes to catch and get rid of the ball. It really reminded me of some of those post-ups, those interior post-ups with the two-handed power cradle that Brian Cole used to use. And then Jack Dowd from Salisbury. I'm going to call him Casey Dowd more than once this season. Mm-hmm. I am sure of it, and I will just preemptively apologize. But Armitage is 6'4". Dowd is 6'5", and even thicker than that. He struggled hitting the cage on Saturday, so it wasn't a day to write home about. Shout out to his Salisbury contingent. I believe it's Joe Carrozza was the one who initiated the introduction, but they were there cheering on their old compatriot. And, you know, he was getting his looks. He was playing, I believe, at the point on Man Up. And so what was interesting about the size that they brought is how small, comparatively, they are at attack. Now, Eric Spanos is big, so not going to dispute that. Brayden Urksa is not very big, nor is Daniel Kelly. And what is interesting about the combination of the role that the transfers played is that that group, that Urksa, Spanos, Kelly group, felt like a solid unit. It didn't feel like they were still trying to figure it out or piece things together. And talking to Tills after that first scrimmage against Lehigh, you know, he didn't close the door on the fact that they were trying to figure it out. And he emphasized it insofar as, you know, if you remember how last season unfolded, it included a swap of Urksa and Spanos from the midfield to the attack and vice versa. And so, you know, I think the supposition or expectation that they were going to be solid at attack coming into this with those three specifically was probably maybe not what they expected. And maybe they didn't feel the way that I did, but I thought that that group played like a unit and they played very complementary to each other. Daniel Kelly still coming back off of a hip labrum surgery, but accelerated recovery rate. So, you know, I don't know that he scored, but he definitely played with a little bit of pop. And then the other thing about the size is that, you know, some of the guys that graduated made room for some of the younger guys that were on the roster last year who made their presence felt a little bit more. And Elijah Stobaugh was probably the number one in that group. I thought that he had one of the highlights of the day when he drew a double team at GLE, rolled back, split the double team, saw the third defender come through the defense, and then found Urksa on the backside for an easy finish. That was a really nice play. And then Jack Schultz, the freshman attackman from Ridgefield, Ridgewood? The one in New Jersey. I believe Ridgewood is the answer. Who was playing a little bit of midfield. He wasn't inverted, but he dodged really deep into the defense and got below the net, and he threw a nice cross-field pass to Elliot Dubuck for another highlight assist on the backside for a step down. So came away impressed by the Maryland offense in terms of their ability to grind sustainably, if that makes sense. I don't think that goals came easy, but I also didn't come away from it saying I think they're going to struggle to find ways to score goals. Now, with that being said, Lehigh was playing without its starting rope unit, and their returning goalie, Nick Pecora, started against Penn State. They let Casey Heath, who's the backup, who actually was tremendous in the U-20 tryouts and might be in the conversation for one of the best backups in all of college across, I thought played really well against the Terps, to offset playing without Richard Cechko, the All-American LSM, and some of the short stick D-middies who bring a lot of leadership to the Lehigh group. But, yeah, I think from the face-off standpoint, Sean Dow is – you know, he was an All-Patriot League selection last year, and I think he's probably got an eye on an honorable mention or third-team All-America look this year. He was highly touted coming out, but had to sit behind Mike Sisselberger for a couple of years, and now his time. And he played well, and I think Maryland decided to go with a quarter-by-quarter approach, and I think they started slow. And then I thought Shea Kiefler scoring in the mid-late second quarter went a long way toward maybe – putting a smilier face on the performance of the faceoff X relative to their early struggles. And then I think they kind of settled in, but make no mistake. And I think Tills understands this. It's not going to be what it was at the end of Luke Wierman's career. But if it is what it was at the beginning of Luke Wierman's career, then the focus is on improvement. And, you know, that's what they're going to need out of Sean Kreider or Kiefler, whoever it is that ends up taking the lion's share of the draws.
Yeah, with Lehigh, you mentioned Dow and Will Scudder, the head coach, now going into his second year as head coach. He was a faceoff guy at Lehigh himself. He, you know, obviously was a mentor to Mike Sisselberger and a number of really good faceoff guys. And Lehigh, your point about having the best backup in the league, that seems to be a consistent theme for Lehigh over the past 6 years or so. So interesting for them being able to kind of stockpile two really good goalies on every roster. Moving a little bit west to Penn State, the Nittany Lions You know, they're a team that I feel like in the Big Ten I have the least grasp on in terms of like where they're at, what to expect for them. You know, even some of their personnel, you know, Jackie Moan was someone who I was curious to see him coming over from Rutgers, how much he made an impact on this team. So I don't know about you guys, but I feel a little bit most like, I'm starting from more of a clean slate with Penn State. So curious what your takeaways were from them.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it kind of in keeping with the precedent set earlier in the conversation, I think, you know, life without TJ Malone is one of the big questions that the Nittany Lions are going to try to answer. And, you know, I would actually harken back 2 years to when I saw the Nittany Lions in the fall after they had come off of back-to-back losing seasons. And, you know, getting Jack Traynor and Malone back from injury, and then also complementing that with the big transfers in from Binghamton and St. Lawrence. And it just seemed like an adult group at the time, the fall of 22, but for the 23 season, in a way that they hadn't been in 2021 and 2022, when Tambo had been less willing or more reluctant to dip into the transfer portal and augment his roster that way. And so I think the reaction to this, they played without Matt Traynor, so certainly, you know, the role that he is going to fill is going to be an important one, whether he, you know, kind of steps into a TJ Malone esque quarterback role. You know, we'll see a little bit. Kyle Lehman was playing a little bit of midfield, a little bit of attack, as he, I think, is recovering from an injury. And so, you know, the attack was much more oriented around Will Peden and Liam Matthews, who I thought did a really nice job of controlling some tempo and getting the team into two-man games. They scored off for a number of them, whether they be actual picks that landed or probably more often slipped picks that created open looks on the backside. But I thought that they were able to, again, kind of like Maryland, grind out sustainable goals in ways that at other points throughout, and certainly when they were held scoreless in the third quarter versus Lehigh after, I think, putting up 5 on the board in the second quarter, much to Nick Pecora's dismay, they showed, you know, there are going to be times when this is a struggle, but again, at that point in the third quarter, they were already subbing against Lehigh's number twos that came in really motivated and played really well. So I think that, you know, something is similarly true for Chase Mullins as maybe it was for the Maryland faceoff guys going up against Dow. He probably had a little bit more success. I was not statting. But yeah, it certainly wasn't as if Penn State had the field tilted their way, despite the fact that they came out, I believe, with an 11-3 victory.
Maybe it's just my affinity for guys who are like over 6'4", but did you have any impressions from Hunter Aquino?
Yeah, he had a really significant, I would call it a juice goal. And I think the reason had less to do with the time and score circumstance and more to do with the fact that he was sweeping topside toward his bench at his bench's end of the field, and he hammered a shot on the run. So I was standing right there at the end of their bench, but the way in which he celebrated facing all of his teammates, and I think it was his second goal because I think he had scored against St. Joe's in their first game, but it was definitely a lot of emotion and a strong celebration. It's funny because Samuel Aquino came away with the sense that he's skinny. I didn't. I think he already has a lot of that lean muscle and strength on a 6'5" frame that makes him very difficult to stop when he gets ahead of steam. I think the question for him is going to be, our defense is going to allow him to get the head of steam? Is the Penn State offense going to allow him to get that head of steam? Are they going to design it for him? And if not, is he going to be able to develop enough telephone booth quickness in order to not allow defenders to get up inside of him and really disrupt his ability to make something happen? And I think that's a normal question for a freshman is, you know, as you graduate up through difficulty levels, what worked at the prior level might not work now. How are you going to utilize your physical advantages to the best of your team's benefit?
Team, and I know you didn't see them as much in person, but St. Joe's, a team that graduated 137 of 209 goals from last year. You know, that was an offensive group that, again, was seemingly there forever and just played a lot of minutes and was really a backbone of the team for a while, although that is kind of doing a disrespect to the defense because they have some monster defenders on that roster and have been on that roster for the past few years of success. The thing that really intrigues me is Richie LaCalandra, you know, kind of maybe getting a little more of the keys and getting his chance to get out there and put in some significant minutes, which is something we haven't really seen from him in most of his college career.
Yeah, and I think that is the way that Taylor Ray feels as well. I saw him at the PLL championship game, actually, and he mentioned that Richie was back and eligible and that he was going to mean a lot to who they were. And then, you know, certainly that was San Liquido's impression from watching him. And I talked to Taylor in between their game against Penn State and Maryland, and, you know, they had a similar pattern to both as they jumped out to 3-0 leads in each game. And so, you know, kind of that coming out with your hair on fire element. And he was pleased. He was excited. They certainly are going to be about as different as any team in the country, but they actually are going to be a little bit more consistent, and they bring back a little bit more veteran experience defensively down low than you might otherwise expect. And so not a bad place to build from, especially for a team who, you know, if you remember when they graduated Zach Cole, we wondered, all right, what is this group going to be like if they can't win 70% of their faceoffs? It is fair to ask, right? You know, Matt Bulmer, Carter Page, Levi Anderson, these guys were so good. Certainly Colin Reich, like, what are they going to be with a new look offense? It's a fair question to ask, but, you know, they're going to be older than they otherwise would have been because of LaCalandra's presence. And one of the things that Ray said is that he knows the offense. So even though he hasn't played in it, his learning curve is not going to be super steep. And that'll be something else that'll be important for the Hawks.
Yeah, they're a team that, like, when we get to Towson a little bit later in this conversation, I visited their fall ball practice. I put them in the same boat as probably, you know the headliners who are gone, but there's probably more people on that roster than you realize who are really talented football players. But before we leave the Philadelphia, Wilmington area, let's go over to your alma mater, Solecianum, North Carolina versus Yale. You got to go to the old stomping grounds and cover that game 2 weeks ago.
To be clear, you're addressing this at Kevin Brown.
At Kevin Brown, yes. So Kevin, first of all, welcome back to your alma mater. Second, what were your takeaways?
Yeah, no, obviously a picturesque setting in the Salesianum venue. It was my first time back. They really refurbished everything up there. It used to be Boehner Stadium, now Avicenna Stadium. So very cool to be back up there at the alma mater for sure. But seeing Yale versus North Carolina, sort of the polar opposite of the Georgetown-Virginia defensive battle, where I think any time you expect to watch the Bulldogs on the field, you're going to see a lot of pace, you're going to see a lot of offense, you're going to see a lot of goals, right? So I think similar to Maryland, the starts at the faceoff X. And what a battle we had in Wilmington with Machado Rodriguez versus Brady Wambach. And they were really going at it from the opening faceoff. There were about three big hits on that opening draw. And guys were just super excited to get after another team in different color jerseys for the first time this fall. So that was fun. And then watching Rodriguez, who missed the last four or so games of that season, went down in that Dartmouth game, pulled up lame. He looked very healthy, looked very good early, won 10 or so of the first 15 faceoffs, and I think that really paced the Bulldogs to a terrific start offensively. And that's really the story of the day for them. Of course, we don't care about final score. They ended up on the losing side around unofficial 18-15 final score I tallied. But the far and away biggest story for me was on their offensive end. They graduated Matt Brandau. And remember, Brandau, his last season in college was devoid of two of the best Yale offensive players last year with Leo Johnson and Chris Lyons both out to season-ending injuries before the season even began. So seeing them both back healthy was super encouraging for Yale fans. And I was super lucky. I was like, hey, I'm going to go down the field level, get a quick video of just the scene. As soon as I do, Christian Johnson comes down there, short-stick defensive midfielder for Yale. And Leo Johnson's calling for the ball, getting some early offense going. This is the second or third quarter. He's like, hey, give me a pick or something. Ignores it, goes down the alley, fires it right into his buddy Chris and Lyons, fakes the behind the back, and then just fires a behind the back shot right into that bottom left. It was just a great showing of these two are totally back. That jump started Chris Lyons' natural hat trick. He scored three in a row, part of his, I think, 4-1 on the day. So he's back doing what he does best in finding the back of the net. Terry, you said this to me at one point this offseason where I thought Chris Lyons was just such a natural goal scorer for Yale. And I kind of just pigeonholed him into that role. So seeing them two share a lot of the ball handling and initiating in this offense, of course, it was mostly Leo Johnson who ended up with 9 or 10 points on the day. I think I had him with 4 and 5. But Chris Lyons, a great play from him. He split left, split back right, just a great dodging move, and finds David Anderson, who thrived in that same Chris Lyons role from 2 years ago, and he finished. He had a couple goals in the day. So a lot of weapons on this Yale offense that was without Brad Sharp, that was without Carson Cool, who made that move down to attack to replace Johnson last season. So they weren't full strength, and they were really firing on full cylinders a couple weekends ago. So that was the story of the game for me, seeing Yale's offense fully back at it. But on the other end, while it started at the face-off stripe, I really enjoyed watching the depth that the Tar Heels boasted at the midfield position, right? The number 10 ranked recruit, Mason Sushik, is just an animal, an absolute monster of a midfielder out of the Chicago area from Culver Academy in Indiana. He did a lot more inverting than I expected. A couple of mom goals hitting the near side, side netting, but some encouraging stuff in something he takes pride in, being a more versatile and skilled player, not just this meaty, super athletic 6'3", 6'4", bulldodging midfielder that can kind of run you over. No, he's got a full dodging arsenal and package to him. He was joined by guys like Ryan Levy, who's got some senior leadership in him. He's kind of taking charge of the second unit on that midfield with freshman Luke Macaluso, who I'm excited to see flourish, given some opportunities on that offensive end. But just a lot of guys are back for this Tar Heel unit that was without Andrew Price, was without let me see here, Ty English, another guy in that two-way role who really flourished throughout the day, just constantly making a lot of plays on both ends of the field. So all in all, just really fun watching both teams go at it in which was a very high-scoring affair.
Christian, you had mentioned earlier about, best goalie in the country. And, you know, there might have been the best goalie in the country on the field of this scrimmage, Mike Gianficaro. Someone who transferred to North Carolina, obviously Princeton guys, they don't really have the luxury of that extra year. Did he look as good in blue as he did in orange?
100%. And he really took command of that defense from the get-go. He was orchestrating the clear. He looked really comfortable in between the pipes. Of course, your first action in new colors being against Yale is a tough ask when they play with that much pace and you know you're going to see a high volume of shots. But he's used to it, right? Ivy League rivals, from his days at Princeton, and he's gotten the better of him on a few occasions wearing those colors. So he did really well, and he looked the part in the post Colin Krieg era for this Tar Heel defense that returns an accomplished freshman from last season, Peter Tomlin, and he was tasked with that Leo Johnson matchup, and for the most part did really well. Of course, Johnson is going to get his, and he had a lot of points on the day, but Tomlin is not going to like force any mistakes or really try to take the ball away too much, but try to stay in front of his guy and communicate through picks as best he could. And that was super encouraging to see for the Heels.
I will say, Matt, I forgot to mention to the conversation about best goalies in the country that Logan McNaney was in attendance but not dressed for Maryland. He was warming up the goalies, and the Terps went with Brian Ruppel as the starter in both outings, and in the scrimmage against Lehigh, Wes Schmidt was the first goalie off the bench to come in and take on the Mountain Hawks.
Another guy I want to mention quickly, the North Carolina and Nick Dupuy on offense. He looked pretty good coming off a monster season for the Seawolves, another Stony Brook transfer coming away from that program. He had upwards of north of 40 assists last year and was a real calming presence for this North Carolina offense. He had a nice look inside of Macaluso, who I mentioned earlier, and a nice goal down the alley in kind of a scramble situation with a flag down for the Heels, who were pretty young in that position. Again, they had a lot of injuries, right? I mentioned Andrew Price, Antonio DeMarco, but the big name was the ACC Freshman of the Year last season in Owen Duffy. He missed – he had that huge brace on his leg, of course, at the end of last season. He's going to miss the whole fall ball season as they ease him back from injury. Want to be super cautious with him. And Dominic Petromala is more of a day-to-day case for North Carolina. So without two of their starting attackmen, I thought some encouraging signs from the midfield. Again, mentioned Sushik and others. Spencer Wertheim coming over from Cornell. And Ty English rounded out that first-line midfield, which is pretty impressive to boast that with all the injuries, but I really like what I saw from them. And on the other side, another transfer I want to shout out, Andrew O'Berry coming from Harvard. He is, like Sushik for me, just so much bigger in person. Once you get to field level, you really get a firsthand experience of just how much force these guys can play with. And O'Berry was a monster on the defensive end, but especially they graduated that the Bucknell grad transfer from last season, Danny Striano, who was a monster on the wings of faceoffs. O'Berry was super great. That kind of turned the tide as they started to rest Rodriguez a little more throughout the contest. Wambach and others for the Heels really sparked that comeback. They scored 7 or 8 unanswered for North Carolina to ultimately come out on top. But O'Berry will be, I think, in the conversation for first or second team All-American with even more eyes on him in the ACC Conference in 25.
Sweezy, anything that you want to know about Carolina and Yale that we haven't hit on yet? Or should we finish up with Towson and Hopkins practices?
No, I think it was pretty thorough. Thank you for asking.
Matt, you hit up Towson with Dan Abern on Monday, October 14th. What were your takeaways of the Tigers?
Yeah, I kind of alluded to it with St. Joe's. You know, they're another team that, like, you see the guys that they, you know, the main guys they lose. Nick DeMeo, who had 50 assists last year. Colby Barris, who was an All-American type defenser, who, you know, was their number one. And you maybe think, you might be apt to think, like, all right, this is a team that, you know, they had their run last year, and, you know, now they're going to kind of go back to the mean a little bit. But I was certainly impressed with the number of Big contributors that they have back after DeMayo, it's their next seven leading point scorers are all back, and that includes Mikey Weishaar, who looked every bit of a first-team All-American in practice. He was certainly the quickest guy there. He had a this just like run underneath. You thought he was going to go to the middle, but instead he kind of just cut back and went underneath and somehow ended up in a situation where he finished behind the back on the crease. That was super impressive. Chop Gallagher is another guy. He was a 23 goal, 20 or so assists last year guy. He's involved in every single play that they do. He's got some size. You know, it's not a team that has a ton of size, I would say, overall, especially with Joaquin Villagomez was not there in practice. You know, he's a guy who brings some size to their attack. So, you know, for them, they're going to have to figure out how to fill Nick DeMayo's production. But I do think that, like, when you look at Towson, they have so many options of guys who are there. And, you know, one of the things that was unique about them last year, you know, they weren't a team that did a lot of the transfer portal stuff. So when they made their run to win the CAA and go to the NCAA tournament, you know, that was a whole bunch of guys who weren't necessarily contributors from the year before, but were on the roster and coached by the coaching staff and led by the guys above them, that kind of when they got their chance, took advantage of it and made it to the NCAA tournament. That's kind of a similar vibe that I get this year of just like, all right, you've had guys who are, you know, maybe playing that second or third role are now going to go up to the first or second role. You know, it really feels like there's a lot of positive activity. In terms of the practice, you know, I've been to many Towson practices over, you know, the course of, I don't know, 11, 12 years or something like that. I would say it was less intense, but I don't mean that in a critical way as much as just more like it was just a confident, like, all right, we're here to do a job. It wasn't like phony rah-rah stuff. You know, it wasn't like guys running at each other and trying to kill each other just to prove a point. You know, it felt like a confident group, maybe not necessarily the most like in your face group, which I think is probably good for them. And I think it kind of fits their identity a little bit. One other thing about Towson that I think is, you know, the theme that I'm going to write with is kind of like, it's not the Towson that you think. I think everyone perceives them as this, you know, team that's heavy on Baltimore County guys and, you know, a state school kind of thing. And they do have, you know, obviously their share of guys from Calvert Hall, from, you know, certainly the Baltimore County public schools and private schools. But man, they've got a really diverse, like, roster. When you think of Chop Gallagher from Portland, you think of Alex Roussel, who was the guy who had that big game against Syracuse in the NCAA tournament. He's from Ontario. You know, you've got guys like Elijah Smith was one of the really kind of true takeaways from this practice. He's an LSM. He's been their second LSM. He's from Nebraska. He's a guy that Natalie encountered him December of his senior year at an event. And, you know, 8 months later, he was at Towson, and now he's going to be a key contributor on their defensive end, a super athlete who, you know, obviously has grown there under this coaching staff and, you know, really has added a lot of skill to go with his athleticism. So I think Towson's just a little bit different than what, you know, your perception of them might be.
Towson is such an interesting preseason team for me this season, because I feel like we underestimated them more going into last season. And though they do lose Nick DeMayo, we are familiar with a lot of these guys. Mm-hmm. Even if it goes against a little bit of the theme of what you're going with here. But what do you think the ceiling is for this group in terms of it's tough for me to gauge whether they should be closer to that 10 to 12 ranking or that 18 to the 20 ranking going into preseason.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think it's certainly one of those like their ceiling, when you look at it at the end of the year, is certainly competing for the CAA championship. I think it's no doubt that them and Delaware are certainly going to be in that mix of, like, you know, one of these two teams is probably the favorite for the CAA. I haven't seen Delaware yet this fall to, you know, say which one is better than the other, but this is a team that can win it again. And remember, you know, under Natalie, you know, there was a stretch where Towson had a remarkable level of consistency in terms of going to and winning CAA championships. So, you know, it feels like it's certainly going to be them in that same boat. And remember, Delaware is soon going to be, you know, not in the CAA anymore. So you wonder if it's going to be kind of the start of a, you know, another run of Towson kind of being the big dog in that conference for an extended period of time. But I would put them, you know, we had them in the way ahead ranking at 19. I think that's fair, maybe a spot or two up from there, depending on how a few things shake out. Because again, you know, obviously they have a lot of guys, but I kind of put them in the boat of, for the longest time, we had the toughest time assessing UMass heading into the season. UMass was the team that every time we thought they were going to be awesome, we ranked them really well, and they had a pretty average season. When we kind of didn't say a thing about them, you know, was when they were competing to win the CAA or knocking off teams in the regular season. I kind of like, I'm hedging my bets a little bit in the fact that maybe Towson is that team where, like, it's just kind of like, maybe we don't know how to predict this team. You know, there's so many factors that are going to have to go, you know, when you're not led by, you know, they have Weishar, but, you know, it's certainly not like a group of star players that lead Towson. So it's going to be kind of these guys who are playing their roles and just kind of inching up and playing well. And you know, how many of them is it going to take to kind of make up for one guy with 50 assists? You know, I'm not sure we can easily predict that. Terry, though, I'm more interested in your practice visit because you were just down the other end of Charles Street a few days prior to me at Johns Hopkins. And, you know, when I think of teams with losses, I think of Johns Hopkins. Whether or not that's truly the correct assessment, but that's certainly my perception is that they're a team that lost among the most in the country, Johns Hopkins. So how did that manifest itself? Whereas I saw a team that felt veteran, you know, with so many, the depth of contributors back, did you feel like this was a team that maybe was like figuring out its identity or kind of like still in a like infancy state, you know, given that they don't have a lot of the guys that they relied on last year?
No question about it. And I think that the answer is a little bit different from the way in which your question expected. And it's because Pete Milliman is coaching the offense alongside Brian Kelly now. And what, in the way that you've been to the last several years of Towson practice, I've been to the last several years of Hopkins fall practice. I think I've been to all of them since Milliman took over. And I was joking with him after the practice ended. You know, the first year was very clearly about competing in the way that he felt like was necessary in order to be successful at that level. I felt like there was a very clear increase in emphasis on detail orientation and focus on details in year two. And I haven't committed to memory what the intervening year's theme, quote unquote, was. But originally, when I started talking to him after practice, I was like, I don't really know what the theme of this is. And then throughout the conversation, as his voice became more animated, talking about the intricacies of the way that they were going to play offense, I realized the theme is Pete Milliman is coaching the offense. And I think there's an important corollary to that. I think there are actually two. The first is that, and this is my supposition, this is me maybe imposing this opinion on him in the situation, not him saying it, but I do think that being a head coach requires a lot of off-field responsibility that until you get used to the pacing and demands of it, you have to allow yourself a lot of time in order to be able to handle it. Because if they don't handle it, it's important stuff, and if it goes undone, it's really bad for your program. And so it's reasonable that you would delegate as much as possible to your assistants in terms of the on-field stuff because they can't do the off-field stuff for you. So it's also reasonable that 4 or 5 years in, those demands are fewer, not because they're actually fewer, but because you know what they are and you're way more efficient about handling them and how to handle them. And then you can utilize that extra time in order to be able to spend more time on the on-field stuff. And that was, so I think that was one of the reasons that he restructured his staff in the way that he did, in addition to the more important reason, which was maintaining the continuity of being able to, you know, keep Jameson Kester, who's recently been promoted to associate head coach, as well as Kelly, as well as John Cohen, who had been in the director of ops, and then Chase Erlin, who graduated as a goalie and became the director of ops for the program and is now working with the goalies. So with that being said, the other thing that I think has kind of allowed Milliman to be more focused on the offense is that while they graduate a lot, they actually are a little bit more similar defensively than you might otherwise expect. Returning two close starters in Scott Smith, who's back after some uncertainty with an appeal that ultimately went through, and then Quentin Kilrain, who started as a freshman last year. So they do have to replace Bo Zulik, who was the third starter, and Jacob Stabner, who played a lot. But they also have a fair amount of experience at the long pole with Patrick Deans and Carson Brown. They're really excited about freshman Tyler Eye. They were decimated at the short stick D-midi position, but they brought in a pair of transfers in Jack Monfort and Patrick Hackler from Yale, who are just Yale transfers. I mean, we have seen very few of them be busts as grad transfers, and we've seen more of them be instrumental in super successful seasons, be it Jackson Morrill and Lucas Kotler at Denver, or, you know, certainly Chris Fake and Brian Tevlin at Notre Dame. And so I think that there's actually a little bit more solidness at the defensive end. And so as a result, I think you've seen, or I saw, a lot more individual focus, both in terms of skill development and in terms of kind of personnel machinations at the offensive end. I think that they still have a lot of questions to answer. I think the most important is Jimmy Ayers ready to take on the role that Jacob Angelus played last year, or is Dylan Bauer going to need to step in there and be flanked by Russell Melendez and Hunter Chavette? If he's not, and Ayers is able to take on that role, then I think they're very comfortable with their first midfield that includes Matt Collison alongside Bauer and Brooks English, who missed almost all of last year due to injury. And then, as has kind of been a theme over the course of this podcast, I think there's a lot of depth to choose from in terms of that second and potentially maybe even a third midfield group. So, yeah, I mean, you know, again, I'm going to get into this a little bit more into the article, but it was really around, you know, some of the individual points of coaching emphasis that Milliman was making offensively that differentiated my visit from prior years.
Nice. And we got to get on the road to some more teams. You know, I've been itching to get some more practices. Towson was the first one that I've done this fall. Eager to try to late this week or maybe early next week, get to a few others and then keep the scrimmages going. We've got a fall ball calendar on the website that has a list of all of the top scrimmages that are going on across the country. This weekend is going to be highlighted by Navy, Penn, and VMI are playing at Bolus. And then one that I'm, you know, interested in is Loyola Marquette and Richmond are playing at Loyola. You know, definitely a new coach there at Marquette. And Richmond is a team that has been remarkable for its consistency. And Loyola is a team that we're kind of looking to see how they bounce back into this year. And then a few other scrimmages going on. Detroit Mercy, Lehigh, and Michigan are at Michigan. Drexel, Lafayette, and Penn State at Penn State. So lots to catch up on next week and in the weeks after that. And it kind of comes and goes. You know, basically after 2 weeks from now, we're going to be talking about, we're going to be done fall ball, and we're going to be heavy into the sprint to the spring season. Can't wait.
Thank you guys for joining us on the Inside of the Cross podcast. If you like what you heard, leave a rating, review, tell a friend, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside the Cross podcasts. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Kev.
Thank you.
Peace.
Inside the Cross Podcasts, the source of the sport.